Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at GayMormonStories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Danny Parkinson back for another installment of Gay Mormon Stories. Today I am continuing with my series of interviewing gay people who come from other strong religious traditions, especially ones where it is very difficult to adjust with the reality of being gay. Today I'm speaking with Stephen Johnson. He was raised in the Jehovah's Witness tradition, and so he's agreed to tell us his story. So
just give me a real quick introduction then.
Okay, yeah, I'm Stephen Johnson. I live in Riverside, California. I've been out of the religion for a little over 2 years now, and I'm currently working as the webmaster for UCR and enjoying my life.
Okay, so you're there in Southern California. Is that where you're from?
Yeah, I grew up in the Artesia Cerritos area.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Tell me about your family background and your heritage and your predecessors and your tradition within the whole Jehovah's Witness religion and the community.
Okay. None of my extended family were Jehovah's Witnesses at all. So both my parents grew up in actually really widely differing backgrounds. My mother was raised by a stepmom, and her dad was a neurosurgeon, so they had a lot of money, and she came from a very wealthy background in Oklahoma. And my dad came from a farming background in Missouri. And so my mom was actually disowned by her family for marrying my dad. She was cut out of the family money and cast out because they felt that she was marrying beneath her status.
She converted into Jehovah's Witness by marrying your dad. Is that right?
No, actually, my dad was not a witness. He was. She got converted by some people who came to the door, and they placed what they called at the time the Truth Book. It was this little blue book, 192 pages, that was called The Truth That Leads to Everlasting Life. And back in the late 60s, early 70s, they had a six month study campaign, where basically they would place the Truth Book with you and you would study for 6 months. And after the 6 month period, you either got baptized or you were dropped. And so my mom bought into it, hook, line, and sinker. She loved everything she heard and she converted. That was probably about, I want to say, a year before I was born.
Okay. So
and
my dad had already married your father.
Yeah, they were already married. She converted, he did not, and his mother was extremely upset that she became a Jehovah's Witness. She was a hardcore Catholic, and she made a lot of issues for my mom and for my dad especially. And so they had a really hard time the first few years that my mom became a J-Dub because he was not having it. He didn't like it, and it almost split their marriage up from what I understand. And,
okay.
But she held to it. And, you know, there's a large majority of people, like women in the organization, have unbelieving mates, is what they call them, you know, husbands that don't follow the religion. And so they do a lot of stuff to help them understand, like, how to treat the husband, how to make it easier on him so that he accepts what you're doing, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Is that possibly because it's the women who are home and or used to be the women who were home when the people would go door to door, so they were more likely to be engaged in it? Or why is that a phenomena?
I imagine that's part of it, at least. I think another aspect of it is that most men, if they aren't raised as a witness, they generally don't care that much about religion to jump into something new. You know, most men are not emotionally attached to the idea of a god or a religion or whatever. So I think it's, to me, that at least that's how I feel about it, is that, you know, I remember thinking when I was, you know, when I used to go out and go door to door and talk to people, I would think, like, you know, if this were me and somebody came to my door, there's no way in hell I'd listen to these people. I didn't care. I would have been just mad that they were bothering me when I was trying to watch TV. And so I think that's probably the bigger side of it, is that it just doesn't resonate with men as much as it does with women sometimes.
Well, that's interesting, because Mormonism is the other major proselytizing religion, and I am not sure that same phenomenon exists. I don't think there's a big gender difference. There might be a small one among converts, but so that's interesting.
Well, I think it might have a lot to do with the area, and you know, probably the religious differences as well. I mean, honestly, being a Jehovah's Witness is not an easy religion. You know, it's not something you can just say, oh, I'm one of Jehovah's Witnesses and I go to their meetings occasionally and that's it. It's something that it takes up time, you know, every day of the week. So,
well, Mormonism is a little bit like that too. But I think it'll be fun to talk about that commonality. But so let's go into how this impacted your childhood, because when you were initially growing up, that is, you had a mother who was participating, but it wasn't necessarily the family religion. So were you being brought up a Jehovah's Witness child?
Yes, I was. My parents made the decision to raise us as Jehovah's Witnesses. I think mostly because my dad was not around. He was an undercover drug enforcement agent for the, and so he would be gone for days at a time occasionally, you know, and his work was stressful enough that when he came home, we actually lived in a very like June and Ward Cleaver kind of arrangement where my dad came home at the same time every day. My mom would break out the vacuum cleaner about a half hour before he got home, and she'd put like this fragrant stuff it was one of those old vacuums with the water in the bottom of it. And she'd put some like fragrant perfume in there, and she'd vacuum all the carpets in the house so the house smelled all nice and fragrant for him to come home to. Just before he came home, we were sent to our rooms so that he didn't have to deal with us when he walked in the door. You know, it was that kind of lifestyle. It was very 50s. You know, she set his clothes out for him in the morning. Dinner was at the same time every night. And when he came home, the TV belonged to him. It didn't matter what you were watching. And it didn't matter that all he wanted to do was watch the news over and over again all night long. And so it was his house. He owned it. And that was it.
And was this a dynamic that he was insisting on? Or was this something that she brought into the family, this kind of interaction?
I think it was more her than him. Because, I mean, like I said, back in the day... And they're not as really as like pushy about it anymore. But back in the 70s, early 80s, the Watchtower Society was very adamant about women who had unbelieving husbands to make sure that every aspect of their life was completely happy, that there was no reason for their husband to complain about their life. Because it was the whole concept from Peter about winning over your mate without a word. I can't remember the exact scripture, but it's the book of Peter. He talks about women with unbelieving husbands and that they could win them over without a word. And so that was kind of the Watchtower's viewpoint, was that if you're giving your husband this perfect life and he sees what an amazing wife you are, he's going to attribute that to the fact that you're one of Jehovah's Witnesses, and that's going to make him say, hey, I want to be one too.
Really?
You know, but for my dad, it was just like, yeah, woohoo. I get dinner at the same time and the house smells good all the time. So, yay.
Yeah, well.
So he didn't really take much interest in... He took interest in my older brother, but all of the interest he tried to take with him was kind of squashed. Like, my brother did Little League, you know, the baseball thing for kids. And we had, like, bowling and stuff like that. But the Watchtower Society, the Jehovah's Witnesses, they are very anti... doing anything recreational that's not required. So, like, you know, obviously you send your kids to school, but your kids are not allowed to do band, or they're not allowed to do after school sports. And so Little League was classified as an extracurricular activity. And so the elders in the congregation gave my mom a hard time about the fact that my brother was in Little League. So then she in turn gave my dad a hard time about it. And so by the time that he just kind of gave up. By the time I came around to being that age to where I would be doing those kind of things, it was just like not an option anymore, because he wasn't going to fight for it anymore. He'd kind of just given up on that. And he kind of retreated back into his own life, and he did his own thing, and we were raised as witnesses.
Uh-huh. But was it hard for your mother to institute the no holiday tradition?
I have no idea, actually. I wasn't around for that transition. So I don't know, like, if it was difficult for her or not. I know we made some concessions in our family that were probably not really by the book. So, like, for instance, we don't, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses don't celebrate Christmas. But what we did instead was my parents instituted this thing called Johnson Day, where we would all buy each other presents and the kids would get presents and whatever. And of course we didn't decorate or put lights up or anything like that, but it always seemed to fall around the Christmas season, you know?
Okay.
And the excuse for that was that, well, that's when your dad has time off and that's when things are cheaper. And so, I mean, there were like a lot of excuses made, but it was really a compromise I think my mom made to make my dad happy. Because I think it really bothered him that we weren't having Christmas or that he didn't have that opportunity to partake in that kind of stuff. So we didn't have that. And then we were, at least I was, my brother, again, he was kind of old enough that he didn't really get tossed into the mix as well as much as I did. But I got, because my dad wasn't a witness, the other elders or brothers in the congregation made themselves available to kind of be that like spiritual father figure. And so I always had a different brother, like 3 or 4 days a week, who would come over and study with me out of different various, you know, Jehovah's Witness publications, some of which were like, you know, specifically created for youth or younger ones in the congregations. I had these men in the congregation who were filling that role of being my father, because my dad wasn't a witness. In fact, in the organization, we were referred to as orphans because they just considered us to be without a father. Even though we had one, he wasn't a witness, so he therefore wasn't actually our father. We had these other spiritual fathers who were actually, you know, it was insinuated or accepted that they kind of, their word was more valid than his. And throughout our childhood, they had carte blanche to come and take us out in service in the afternoons, come and study with us, you know. And so we spent a lot of time with these people in the congregation, and some of them weren't negative experiences, but a lot of them were extremely negative. Some of the people that I spent my childhood with were abusive physically and mentally, and in one case sexually. And so it was like these things were happening, but I couldn't tell my mom about it. And the physical side of stuff she knew, but, you know, she just accepted that we deserved it. If we got beat up one of the brothers, then we were misbehaving and we shouldn't have done that.
Your father wasn't resenting this, that his role was being usurped? Was it because he was so absent that he wasn't really aware, or did he just become complacent to it?
I don't think he really knew, honestly. You know, his role in our life was in the evenings. And the occasional weekends. And so what happened during the day while he was at work was not his purview. And she certainly wasn't sharing a lot of this information with him because, you know, another aspect to the culture behind Jehovah's Witnesses is that there is a lot of confidential aspects to things. If you have dealings with the elders, those dealings are confidential and they're not to be discussed with other members of the congregation. And they're certainly not to be discussed with people who are not Jehovah's Witnesses, and that would include her husband. Right. So I don't think he knew a lot about what was going on. And I think that if he had known, he would have stepped up and done something about it. Cause I've always kind of resented the relationship that I had with my dad because there just wasn't one. I mean, we did camping trips and we did like excursions to Iowa to visit his mother and stuff like that. But on a day-to-day level, there really wasn't much of a relationship there. And most of my memories of my father are him sitting behind a newspaper.
Okay, so you really were being raised within this religion. And it wasn't a once-a-week religion during your childhood. This was most
No,
evenings.
It was an everyday thing, yeah.
Okay. And I guess I just want to make sure we're really clear that my audience understands this, that Jehovah's Witnesses maintain some separateness from society in part by avoiding observation of any holiday whatsoever. And you also mentioned any extracurricular activities such as sports or band or anything that might be going on at school. So were there other Jehovah's Witnesses or were you the only one?
Throughout elementary school, I was the only Jehovah's Witness. All the other, growing up in Artesia, there was like 15 elementary schools in the area. And so all of my friends from the congregation all went to different schools. And so I was by myself, and we weren't allowed to have friends at school. We weren't allowed to associate with the kids. Anytime that there was like a birthday in the class, we would have to leave the classroom during the birthday celebration or anything that had to do with that.
Did you find this to be hard as a child? Was this something you had some resentment towards when it was happening? Or
I didn't really know any different. And I think as a kid, we were taught that we were better than these kids. That, you know, we had the truth and they didn't. And Jehovah was going to save us, but he was going to kill them. And so why do you want to be with people that Jehovah's going to kill? Like, why do you want to hang out with them? And, you know, from a young age, you're instilled this information is put into your brain that, like, these people that you're going to school with, these kids, they're going to die tomorrow when Armageddon comes. Because, I mean, every day it's Armageddon's coming tomorrow. Armageddon's coming tomorrow. I mean, I was raised being told every day that I would not graduate from school, that I wouldn't get through elementary school, that I wouldn't get through junior high, that I wouldn't get through high school. And so I was never encouraged to do well in school. I was never encouraged to study or get decent grades because it just didn't matter. Armageddon was coming. So why do you want to waste your time learning these worldly things when you could be studying your Bible, or you could be going out in service, or you could be reading the Watchtower? You know, these things took precedence over education or having friends or anything like that. And so, but I didn't know any different. And so it didn't, I don't think I ever resented it. I think in the sixth grade, a good example is the teacher that came in for our class was very prejudiced against Jehovah's Witnesses. And so it upset her anytime I couldn't do one of the holiday projects. And so I remember for Thanksgiving, we were supposed to draw the, you know, the pilgrim ships landing and them doing like, you know, some Thanksgiving dinner kind of thing. And instead I drew something else because I didn't want to like get into her face again because I like it was always happening. And so rather than saying anything, I just did kind of something different that wasn't Thanksgiving related. And so because of that, she took it and held it up to the class and she's like, you know, class, Stephen's religion teaches him that he doesn't have to listen to the teacher and do what he's told. And so from now on, he doesn't get to go to recess. He has to sit in during recess and write, I will obey what my teacher, or I will do what my teacher tells me to do. And so for like a month, at recess, I would just sit in there and I would write that over and over and over again. And I never told my mom because I didn't want to get in trouble. But then one day she found it. She found like the stuff in my backpack and she was like, what's this and what's going on? And so I told her what happened and she just flew off the handle and dragged me down to the school and her and the principal were yelling at each other. And it was funny. Like I remember thinking at the time, like I was so happy that my mom was standing up for me. But I look back now and I realize that it had nothing to do with me. It was her standing up for the religion. Like her religion was being persecuted. And so she was going after that, you know, because I look at the different things that happened in my life that she knew about that she didn't do anything about. And I'm like, it wasn't me. It was the fact that your religion was being called into question. That was the issue.
Yeah. How old were you when that happened?
I think it was about 11, 12. I was in sixth grade. I would have been 10 to 11 because I started a year early. And this was also, this is kind of a side, little like side note, but between the ages of 9 and 13, I had a really bad smoking and drinking problem. I was a massive alcoholic by the time I was 13. And
but how were you doing this if you weren't associating with other kids?
The three witnesses that I hung out with in our little congregation, two of them were basically their parents were fringe witnesses, I guess, and didn't really spend much time or effort in with the religion. They were just kind of there, but because they were still going to the congregation, they were still considered acceptable associates. And so we were able to hang out with them, but one of them introduced me to alcohol and one of them introduced me to cigarettes. And my dad was a massive smoker. He smoked two or three packs a day for years. And so I knew where his cigarettes were kept and I just would take cigarettes from him. And so I developed about a pack a day smoking habit from, I started about 9 years old. I quit that when I was 12, but then I started drinking around 10 ish. And then we moved from Los Angeles to South Dakota when I was 13. And at that point, I couldn't get alcohol anymore. And so I detoxed in a hard way.
Well, so...
Didn't expect that turn, did you?
Yeah, but meanwhile, you're... But let me go back a little bit to your childhood. Just, this is more to educate the audience, but were you allowed to play with other children?
We could play with the kids on the street. So, like, there were, like, the across-the-street neighbors, my family were friends with them, which I always thought was a weird double standard, but I think it was more that my dad was friends with them, and so my mom kind of put up with it. So we'd go camping with them occasionally, and that was kind of our worldly kid exposure. And then, you know, there was a couple of Portuguese kids down the street that we used to hang out with them. And so, like, all the kids in the neighborhood would play. We lived on a little cul-de-sac. We'd all play when we were younger. But, like, having friends at school was frowned on. And I could never go and, like, stay the night at a worldly friend's house. That was totally not allowed. They could come over to our house, but we couldn't go to theirs. And that was mostly because my mom was like, no, I don't trust that their parents aren't going to, you know, do something that's against our religion.
Okay. But meanwhile, with the other kids, you had some fun. I mean, did you have fun times when you gathered with Jehovah's Witnesses? I mean, was this did this seem like a happy place when you'd go to church or when you were hanging out with the other Jehovah's Witnesses? Were you identifying with this as the good moments?
Yeah, I would say so. I don't look back at my childhood and think that the negatives were because of the religion necessarily. I mean, there were a lot of negatives and there were a lot of really severe things that happened, but those were really about the people that were there and not like the religion as a whole wasn't sanctioning that behavior. And, you know, I mean, my best friends were all Jehovah's Witnesses. My entire life was wrapped around it. And so, I mean, yeah, it wasn't a negative thing where it was like I was miserable all the time and I hated my life and this and that. I mean, I had bad experiences and there were, you know, men in the congregation that were horrible people as a whole. And they were put in positions of authority that made it even worse. But at the same time, you know, I think it's more that the culture bred a certain negativity versus it trying to sponsor that negativity, if that makes any sense.
And would you say this was sort of a universal experience? Most Jehovah's Witnesses kind of have the same experience that you're describing.
I think it varies a little bit. And I, having come out of it now in the last couple of years and dealing with a lot of ex-Jehovah's Witnesses and hearing them tell their stories and whatever, I do start to see that there is like kind of a middle ground where most people are very like, whatever, it was a weird religion. I had a lot of isolation as a child. I wasn't happy. I didn't enjoy my life the way I could have been. But I don't think anybody at the time when they were in it was ever like, oh, I hate this and I'm miserable, unless horrible things were happening to them because of the religion, which there is that spectrum, of course. So that's, I think you start at that spectrum where it's like, okay, I was abused constantly in this religion. It was a horrible experience. I would never go back again. Into the more middle ground where it's like, it's a weird religion and it requires you to give up everything in your life for it. And so that's awkward. And then you can go all the way to the other end of the extreme where it's like, I liked being a Jehovah's Witness. I had a good time. There's still a lot of ex-Jehovah's Witness GLBT people out there who believe that they have the truth, that they believe that if they weren't gay, that they would go back and they would be good witnesses.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of them that still try really hard to not be gay so they can get back in. And, you know, it's like, to me, that's just, it's sad.
Okay. So the group of people that, within the Jehovah's Witness who probably have the most negative experiences are possibly because of a vulnerability. And your particular vulnerability was that your father wasn't in the religion. And so you were subjected to these abusive ecclesiastical leaders because you would be assigned to them. Do you think that's why you had this abusive situations going on?
I think so. I think a lot of it is that the elders in the congregation are given a lot of authority over people's lives. And most of the time, those people that have that position in their real life are janitors and window washers and hourly employees who don't have any authority or power. And so when they get into the congregation, all of a sudden they have this rush of authority and, you know, people look up to them and their word is essentially the word of God. You know, and while the religion will always say, no, that's not the way it is, that is so the way it is. If an elder gets up on the platform and he says something, you assume that that elder is getting it from the organization. And of course, the organization is getting it from Holy Spirit, from God. So while that elder is not receiving God's word directly, you're taught to assume that you follow his direction as though it was the direction from the organization, and you follow the organization as though it's the word of God. These men are essentially giving you the word of God on a weekly, daily basis. And so how would, you know, I mean, for somebody who has no real authority or power in their daily life, they get into a situation like that, and all of a sudden it goes to their head.
Uh-huh.
And so there's a lot of what I used to term, you know, short man elder disease, which is, you know, the guy who gets picked on all the time, but all of a sudden has this like rush of power and takes it out.
Okay. Would you say that the reason they're janitors in their life is because they come from a Jehovah's Witness tradition that doesn't really encourage pursuit of education? Is that why the phenomenon exists?
As a Jehovah's Witness, you are told that college is not an option. There is very, very strong counsel about not going to a university or a college. Why would you waste your time doing that? Armageddon's coming. And if you did that, and you are in fact not putting kingdom interest first, and so why would Jehovah bless you?
Uh-huh.
So they really don't want you to get an education at all outside of what is state mandated. And in the 60s and 70s especially, they really wanted brothers to be janitors and window washers. And I mean, they're literally, they had articles in their magazines about, here are jobs you can do and go pioneer. Be a janitor, be a window washer. You know, and those are actually, like, I think if you talk to any Jehovah's Witness that's been around the religion for more than 20 years, and you say janitor or window washer, they'll all kind of giggle a little bit, because it just kind of became a thing. Like, that's what Jehovah's Witness men did. They washed windows and they were janitors. And women were cleaning ladies. And so you were not, like, when I graduated high school when I was 16, and I was essentially told by my mother, like, no, you're not going to college. You can pioneer for a couple of years and then go to Bethel when you turn 18.
Bethel, what's that?
Bethel is the building in New York. If you ever cross the Brooklyn Bridge and you see the big watchtower sign there, that's Bethel. And at 18, you could apply to go to Bethel and serve at Bethel for at least a year, but some people become lifers. But yeah, that's where they print all the materials and do all that kind of stuff.
Okay. And pioneering, what's that?
Pioneering is, like, for Mormons, you guys have your mission.
Yeah.
And that's generally a two-year thing, right?
Uh-huh.
For Jehovah's Witnesses, you're required to preach for your entire life. You have to go door-to-door forever. And for some people, there's two different levels. There's auxiliary pioneering and there's regular pioneering. In an auxiliary pioneer, you could say, like, oh, I don't have much going on this month, so I'm going to auxiliary pioneer, and that means I'm going to put in 50 hours a month.
Uh-huh.
And that means that you've gone out in service for at least 50 hours.
Okay.
A regular pioneer signs up for a year, and so they sign up for a year, and they have to put in 70 hours a month, every month for that year.
Okay.
And those are actually, they might be reduced again. They've been reducing those hours for a while. Like, when I was a kid, my mom was a regular pioneer, and she had to put in 100 hours a month.
Okay.
And then it went down to 90, and then it went down to 70, and I think it's still at 70, but they might have reduced it again in the last couple of years.
So the religious practice, what did it include besides pioneering? So it's not every single member who's going out every week pioneering. This is really the specific people who've signed on to this official status of being either pioneers or auxiliary pioneers.
Yes. There's special pioneers. They do 120 a month, but they are also usually in a foreign country, but they're not missionaries. There's also missionaries that go through Gilead, which is a training program that the society has in New York as well. There's a lot of different levels for that. But the actual rank and file member of the congregation, your average publisher, which is what they're called, is not required, but expected to put in at least 10 hours a month.
Okay. So the most people we see going around are probably rank and file members then.
Yeah. During the week, it's probably a regular pioneer. On the Saturdays or Sundays that people pop in on your door, that's probably a rank and file member.
Okay. And just give me a little more brief introduction to your religious practice. Tell me what it included. Was it primarily Sunday meetings? You're telling me that there was stuff going on all the time. Was it youth groups? Was it just getting together?
And this has changed a little bit in the last five years, I think. But growing up, on Tuesday nights, and the days are different depending on what congregation you're in and that kind of stuff, because sometimes eight different congregations would share the same Kingdom Hall, so they would have different schedules. But for me growing up, Tuesday nights was book study, and that was a one-hour meeting that took place at somebody's house in the congregation. And so Each congregation would have probably six or seven different book study groups. And they would meet at different members of the congregation's houses in smaller groups, and it would be led by one of the elders in the congregation, and it would be the study of one of the publications that the society put out. And so when they finished the book, they'd go into another book, that kind of thing. So that was Tuesday night's book study.
Yeah.
Then Thursday night was the service meeting and theocratic school. And that's two meetings that are basically put together. So first was the theocratic school, which is where they would do a series of five different talks. There was the Bible highlights, which was a progressive, like throughout the course of 1 year, they would go through the entire Bible. So, you know, it wasn't like they started in January, they started in Genesis. It was kind of wherever they ended up being when the year started. But so the Bible highlights would cover like three chapters of the Bible. And a brother would get up and give a 15-minute kind of like talk about what happened in those three chapters, how can we apply it to our lives, why is it important for us to read it.
Okay.
After that was the instruction talk, and that was on various different topics. Those two talks were given by either a ministerial servant or an elder in the congregation. Then the actual school started. It was like a school with a theocratic ministry school overseer. And so I remember, I think I gave my first talk when I was five, I want to say.
Really? Yeah.
And what I gave was the Bible reading, which was the number two talk was the Bible reading, where you got up and you had a series of about 20 or 30 verses, specific verses in the Bible. You would give an introduction, you'd read the verses, and you'd give a conclusion. And so it's almost like a little book report on those verses of the Bible. And anybody in the any male member of the congregation, regardless of age, could give that talk. Sisters were not allowed to give those talks at all. The number three talk was for the sisters. The women in the congregation were not allowed to teach or say anything to the congregation as a whole. They couldn't give talks to the congregation. So instead, what they would do is it would be a sister that's assigned the talk, and then her householder. And so they would, or her partner. And so they would get up and they would do basically a skit where it's a woman at work talking to one of her coworkers. And they would do a conversation where they talk to each other about the material that was assigned. So they were talking to each other, not to the congregation. And then the number four talk was on random topics and was more of a here's the topic, here's the place to do the research, write a 5-minute talk about this. And so you'd get up and give that 5-minute talk. And a lot of that was all basically to train you how to speak about the Bible to people out in the ministry.
Yeah.
So it was almost like a religious version of Toastmasters. Then after that was a service meeting, and that was basically just they would do demonstrations on how to place that week's watchtower at the door. They would do like talks encouraging people to get out in service more often. It was all stuff that related to the ministry and getting out in service more and being more effective when you were out, being a better salesman, so to speak.
Yeah.
So that was Thursday nights. And then Sunday was the public talk and the watchtower study. And so the public talk was a 45-minute discourse given by either one of the local elders or an elder visiting from a nearby congregation. And there's an outline that's provided by the Watchtower Society. And the brothers giving the talk are supposed to follow that outline, although a lot of times they don't. They go off on weird tangents occasionally and whatever. But the idea behind that was that this was a talk that was specifically for people who would be visiting the congregation that weren't not necessarily witnesses. So they were usually like very like motivational, very come to the meetings more often. Very, you know, if you've never been here before, request a Bible study from somebody in the audience, blah, 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 that kind of stuff. And then most of your audience is probably familiar with the Watchtower. They've seen one. They've looked, probably leafed through one, whatever. The Watchtower always had study articles inside each issue, which had questions at the bottom of each paragraph. And so the Watchtower study was a question and answer of those study articles each week. So that was the basic week of meetings for Jehovah's Witness. And then Saturdays, you're expected to go out in service in the mornings. Usually, if your meeting on Sunday is in the afternoon, then they want you to go out in service before the meeting. If your meeting's in the morning, they want you to go out in service for an hour or two after the meeting. And then for me growing up, because my mom was a pioneer, most of my preschool era was spent out in service with her every day. And then any afternoon after school, I would usually get picked up by one of the pioneer brothers and taken out in service with him.
Okay. Well, so it was taking up a lot of your time, huh?
Yeah, like I said, being a Jehovah's Witness is not a religion. It's a way of life.
Well, so let's move then to your youth experience. I mean, you were doing all this, but somehow you were managing to sneak off with a few friends who were also Jehovah's Witnesses and consume alcohol. And would you say that you were considered a big rebel for that? Or would you say this is also maybe a common thing, that the youth are sort of rebelling on the side?
Rebellion, yes. At that age, no. I think the majority of people that when I say that to somebody, even if they were raised as a witness, they look at me like, wow, what happened to you that started that early?
Okay.
But I mean, most of the witness kids that are around, you know, 15, 16, like once they get a car, they kind of go off the rails a bit. And there's a lot of that kind of rebellion and drinking. And, you know, I mean, there's massive scandals that happen. Like, I don't think there's any congregation in the United States, at least, that you couldn't talk to somebody and be like, oh, yeah, I remember when this happened and all these kids got disfellowshipped and their parents got busted. And, you know, like there's always every congregation has some massive scandal story that they can tell you.
Okay. So let's talk about you specifically then as far as your sexual orientation. You know, in Mormonism, when the typical thing in my generation was to develop sexual guilt around the time of puberty. And there, at the time, there was this obsession with masturbation in the community, that they talk about it a lot at church and our youth meetings and stuff. So it created a sort of a scenario where everyone's feeling like they're awful and guilty, right? And then later on, the tone of that changed, but then porn became widely available, you know, with this newer generation, and it shifted the dynamics a little of that. But was this sort of also a phenomena in Jehovah's Witness, this sort of emerging guilt because you're having sexual thoughts and masturbation or...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Masturbation was a massive topic throughout all of our childhoods. I know, like, for me personally, my sexual life began a lot earlier than it should have, but it wasn't like I was being sexually abused. I had a relationship when I was really young with one of the neighbor kids, who was quite a bit older than I was, but by about 6 or 7 years. 6 or 7 years older than me, which is a big deal when you're that young. So, I mean, I would say that the relationship was at best inappropriate, but it wasn't something that I was being forced into. It wasn't like I was being raped or molested by him or anything like that. It was something that I enjoyed, that I wanted in my life. And then, so, I mean, I had these things going on long before anybody thought to tell me not to do those things.
Let me just throw in an educational point. That, you know, sexual abuse with any child is sexual abuse.
Period.
And obviously in this case you were both underage, so in this case it was sexual abuse, but it's different
when it's two children. It was an inappropriate relationship, but
right.
Neither one of us really knew any better to say.
Right. And then my third point is the relative damage that a child gets from sexual abuse is much worse when there's violence involved, when there's force involved. You're right, it was inappropriate, and it still is in the category of sexual abuse, but for, you know, luckily for you, it was the least damaging types of the kinds that are sort of being perpetrated on children. It's much, much more damaging to have an adult actually
well, I think what was more
force themselves in a violent way. And
right. And I think what was more damaging for me is that I was raised to, because of the viewpoints of homosexuality in the organization, I was led to believe that that was forced on me, that I didn't want that to happen. And that was, and so I grew up I spent a lot of years, especially after I had gotten married, thinking that I had been abused as a child throughout my entire childhood, that this was all this horrible sexual molestation and whatever. And, you know, it wasn't until I finally came out and then looked back on those experiences and realized that it was never something that I didn't want. It was always at least in some way consensual on my end as well. I mean, I sought it out. I defended it. I hid it actively, and not because I was afraid of him or whatever. I genuinely had a relationship with him. So anyway, but yeah, so by the time I was old enough to start getting the don't masturbate rhetoric, I had already been doing way more than that. And so it was like, okay. And I had been hiding all that anyway, so it just became another aspect of my life that I kept hidden from everybody. And, you know, which, I mean, I think that's a given anyway. Most kids don't run around masturbating in front of other kids. But, you know, it was something that was ingrained in me that it wasn't allowed, but I was going to do it anyway. And so I always just kind of ignored it. We had a book called Youth Getting the Best Out of It or whatever. We called it the Youth Book. It was this little red book. And chapter 5 was on homosexuality and masturbation. And so the Jehovah's Witnesses for many years attributed homosexuality to masturbation. So basically, if you masturbated too much, you were going to turn gay.
Okay.
That's what they taught.
That's basically what Mormons believe too.
Yeah. And so this particular brother that was studying with me at the time was a dirty piece of garbage that did not need to be alive on this planet. But he basically told my mom that he was going to be having a birds and bees conversation with me, and that, you know, if she could give us the privacy that was needed for that discussion and go grocery shopping or do whatever for a couple of hours, that he would appreciate that because he was going to handle this conversation with me. And I mean, that's kind of what I get at when I talk about the authority that these men have. Uh-huh. Is that, you know, I mean, what parent looks at some random dude who's saying like, oh, I'm going to have a conversation with your son about sex, you need to leave for the next 2 hours, and then does it? You know, it's like, yeah. What? And so she left, and the study, we went through the material in the book that talked about how horrible fags were and that they were going to be destroyed by Jehovah, and that, you know, we would be standing on their naked corpses, you know, after Armageddon and this and that. I mean, none of that was like put that way in the book, but that's the way he was presenting the material. Is uh-huh. That, you know, and so then he went into the whole thing about, okay, this is what oral sex is, this is what anal sex is, and it involved demonstrations and things that I was not thrilled with. And, you know, it was like, I don't know if in his mind he was justifying it, because I don't know what he was thinking. I honestly have no idea.
I'm sorry, so he thought he was pretending he needed to actually show you what you were supposed to not be doing?
Yeah.
And so he started doing the sexual acts with you, and yeah. You were a young adolescent at the time?
I think I was 9 at the time.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, like I said, I had already had a relationship with John, this kid in the street. And so it was confusing to me because I didn't enjoy that experience. Uh-huh. But I did enjoy the experiences that I was having with John. I did like being with John. I enjoyed being around him. It was more than just the stuff that we did. There was an emotional connection with him. This guy was doing things that I didn't want to do. I didn't want to be involved with. I didn't like him. I wasn't attracted to him that way. And so it was very confusing to me because...
And he was an ecclesiastical leader, so this was literally... He was doing something that he should go to jail for.
Yeah. And I was told afterwards that it was confidential, that it was a confidential matter, that I was not to discuss it with my mother or with anybody else in the congregation. That's the way it was kind of presented to me, that like this was, so I mean, there was, and oddly enough, I remember thinking how privileged I was to have this thing between me and the elders, that there was something that me and only the elders knew, you know, and that that was, so I guarded that secret, you know, even years later. I remember a time that came up where I should have brought it up and didn't, because it was still in my head. It was like, well, that's a confidential matter. I can't discuss that. Wow. So, I mean, it's just the way you're ingrained to think about things within the organization, it precludes itself to this kind of activity happening.
Okay. So these must have made the pamphlet seem confusing, though, if he actually wanted to act out what they were telling you not to do in the pamphlet.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that was why it was very confusing, because it was like, okay, we're doing these things, but we're doing them under the guise of like, this is what's going to happen, don't ever do this. As though, like, there were other things that might happen that I was okay to do. It was almost like, and that's another aspect to the religion that's kind of like more of an overall mindset, is that every aspect of your life is controlled down to what movies you can watch, what books you can read, what TV shows you should be watching, music that you listen to, people you associate with. Every little bit of your life is controlled by these series of rules and regulations that, to me as a kid, it was almost like, look, I'm showing you these things because these are the things you can't ever do again. And I had never done either of those things with John, with the guy across the street. We'd never engaged in oral or anal sex. You know, we'd only mutually masturbated, whatever. And so it was like, oh, well, I'm not gay because I don't do those things. And it was okay doing these other things, apparently, because we didn't do those things. He just showed me these things. So I guess this is okay. So I kind of like, it was all like, confusing is I guess the easiest way to put it, but doesn't really kind of quantify what was going on with it. It completely jacked up my whole sense of, A, what it meant to be gay, because in their religion, gay is not a thing. They don't believe in being homosexual. They just believe that you're a pervert, and that being homosexual has nothing more to do than just having sex. And so, since I didn't enjoy having anal sex with this man, I was obviously not gay. And so I was fine with that. And so that just kind of, it threw off the entire, like, everything that I was feeling towards guys versus what I should have been feeling towards girls was all very confusing to me, because I didn't understand that that's what it meant to be gay. I just thought that, like, oh, well, I like guys, I don't like girls. And then it was like later when it was like, oh, well, that's not allowed, and that is actually what it is to be gay. And it was like, but I'm not gay because I don't do these other things. It was just, everything just got skewed, and it was so hard to figure out my place, if you know what I mean.
Right. Okay. But anyway, it's also around that time where you did start doing these other behaviors, the smoking and the drinking. So you were doing some other things that you must have also realized were not approved by your mother and your religious community. And was there a connection to those?
The smoking I did because I enjoyed it. The guy that introduced me to smoking was somebody who was like really cool. He was one of the cool kids, you know, like he was preppy. It was back in the time when preppy was a thing. He was into new wave music. He was the kind of kid that all the kids at school hung out with. And so for me to be his friend, that was really cool. And so I would have done anything he told me to do without question. And so he told me to smoke, and I started smoking. The drinking, I hated alcohol when I first tried it, but we thought we were cool to be drinking. And after we had done a few shots, we kind of figured out what the cool thing about alcohol was. And for me, it just helped me forget. You know, I went through a period where I had a hard time dealing with the fact that my dad wasn't in my life, that it seemed like a lot of things were going towards my brother, but not me, that I had these people in the congregation that were kind of responsible for me, that were, you know, not great people and not treating me well, and that I was this horrible person, obviously. You know, obviously I was making Jehovah angry. I was not living up to who I was supposed to be. I had this problem with masturbation that I was told I couldn't do anymore. I was constantly wanting to see my male friends naked. Like, I had this obsession with wanting to see them naked, which made me feel guilty for even wanting to do that. And so I realized when I was drunk that I didn't think about any of that. That it just made me numb. And I enjoyed that sensation, that feeling of being numb. And so I drank pretty much every day. I would go to school intoxicated. I would come home from school intoxicated. I drank a lot of vodka and gin throughout those years.
And your mother didn't figure this out?
I don't really think that they were paying a whole lot of attention. So,
okay.
Why?
Was she so busy being the perfect wife and then pioneering in her spare time? And
yeah, pretty much. And then at one point we had some financial difficulties, and so she had to take on a job as well. But, you know, she couldn't quit regular pioneering because that would mean that she wasn't relying on Jehovah. And so she was regular pioneering. She had a job. You know, we kind of became latchkey kids for a little while. And so, yeah, I mean, I had plenty of opportunity to do these things without anybody being around. And honestly, I think it was more of a, you're not here, you're not in the way, so I'm not going to worry about what's going on with you.
Okay. So, well, then tell me then, you know, take me through the rest of your adolescence and where did you go from there?
Well, when we turned 13, apparently my dad was miserable living in L.A. He didn't like the traffic. He didn't like pretty much any aspect of Los Angeles. And so unbeknownst to us kids, he had been looking to transfer out of Los Angeles. And so he was accepted to transfer to Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And I had never even heard of South Dakota, let alone Sioux Falls. And we moved out there in 1986, and I had just turned 13. And it was midway through eighth grade, and so I switched into a new school. I right away wasn't well liked because the kids were intimidated by the like stereotypes of Californians. And so they thought that I was gonna be this, like, you know, surfer dude from California and whatever, and so they didn't really want much to do with me initially. And then I had an episode because of the sudden loss of alcohol. Because I took a stash with me while I was there. I took a stash with me that when that finally ran out, I kind of went through a period of withdrawal that created some issues. And so there was like all these things that just kind of made kids not want to be around me. And then also the fact that I was a Jehovah's Witness, which was made very clear by my mother, because that's part of the deal, is that the parents have to go in and talk to each of the teachers and explain to them what their kids can and cannot do. That sort of thing. And okay. there was one other witness kid in the school, but his parents were newly converted. And so he had a base of friends that he'd had his entire life that his mom was now telling him he couldn't associate with, and that he was only allowed to associate with me because I was also a witness. And he wasn't thrilled about that at all. He didn't want to have to hang out with the pariah of the school, and he certainly didn't want to have to give up his other friends. And so right out of the gate, I think about a month after I had started school there, he started a rumor that I'd gotten an erection in the shower, which I had never taken a shower at school. So, it was like, I was like, what are you talking about? Like, when did this supposedly happen? But it didn't matter. I was labeled as being gay, and, you know, they called me shower boy and boner boy and all these other things. And then tack on to that I was about 10, 15 pounds overweight, and you've got the makings for a horrific high school experience. And so the funny thing is him and I eventually did become really good friends. And it was our last year of school together. He one day just like pulled me aside and was like, I need to tell you something. I started this rumor and I'm really sorry. And I'm like, no, it's fine. I knew you did. And I don't blame you. And I was like, whatever, dude, it happened. And, you know, school sucks, but you know, what are you going to do now about it? So, I actually had a good relationship with him, but I mean, when I graduated high school, I was the only kid who walked across the stage and not one single person clapped or whooped or whatever like they did for every other kid. It was like complete silence, and then one kid yelled out the nickname they had for me, and so that was my last little vestige of high school, was you know, even my parents who were in the audience, I don't know if they just didn't know that, like, why no one was clapping, and so they didn't either, but, like, nothing. It was like you could hear crickets as I walked across the stage to get the diploma. And, you know, I look back on it now and I could laugh, but at the time it was like, you know, it was hard. It sucked.
Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of that had to do with, you know, there was an overall, you grow up with this idea that you have to isolate yourself from worldly kids. You have to, you know, so I didn't really push to have any relationships at school. And, you know, maybe if I had, it would have been different. But it was, that's just not something that we were allowed to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, so it all came together in a bad way for you. Everything kind of conspired to make you a pariah at the school.
Right.
A lot of it came out of your religion because you weren't really able to interact appropriately. And then you just happened to move at a really bad time in your,
right,
at a stage of your adolescence. And so,
and then in the congregation, it was a whole different congregation, a whole different culture. There were a lot of really weird things that we didn't experience out here. I will say one thing, the Artesia congregation that I grew up in was very, very much like a family. I do remember that kind of feeling that, like, all of us were extremely close friends. We hung out with each other all the time. There was a huge, I mean, there's still a lot of people in, because I ended up going back to that congregation as an adult. And so there's a lot of people in that congregation that I grew up as looking at as being parental figures or whatever, that were really good people and that were amazing.
Yeah.
And that I have really good experiences with. But when we moved to South Dakota, it was much different. It was a whole different culture in the congregation. People were really isolationist even within the congregation. Gatherings were kind of frowned upon because, you know, who knows what's going to happen. And then the idea that my dad was not a witness was a much bigger issue in South Dakota than it was in Artesia. In Artesia, all the brothers in the congregation were friends with my dad. I think they liked the idea of being friends with a guy who was in the world. But in South Dakota, it was like, nope. None of the families would invite us over because my dad wasn't a witness. A lot of the kids in the hall were not allowed to associate with us because my dad wasn't a witness, or because we were from California, because there was a stigma attached to that as well.
You were being excluded at school because you were Jehovah's Witness, but you were being excluded in your Jehovah's Witness community as well.
Yes. And there were a couple of exceptions, and, you know, those were people that I was very close with because they were all I had. And one of them was a guy in the congregation, and I kind of don't want to go into a lot of detail with this because he's still in the organization, and he's married, and he's not out, and so I don't want to inadvertently get him in trouble.
Okay.
But essentially, I had a relationship in South Dakota, and I think it's safe to say that we fell in love with each other. And then for some reason, I felt the need to turn us in. And so I did. And, you know, because I go through periods of like, okay, what I'm doing is wrong, and I need to do this. I need to be right with Jehovah. Like, I need to make this acceptable. I need to be acceptable and whatever. And it came into that period. Well, at this point, both of us were baptized. When you get baptized as a Jehovah's Witness at an age where you're considered accountable, we were religiously punished for what was going on. There was they have what's called a judicial committee, and that's followed after an investigative committee will go through the motions. So initially, I met with two elders. I explained to them what had happened and what was going on. Then those brothers went to him and his family. And because we were underage, the parents had to be involved. And so they went to him and his family. He initially denied it, said that nothing had happened. So then they came back to me and said, you know, wanted more information. I gave it to them. They went back to him. He realized that this was happening and that he just kind of, so he had to go with it. So they formed judicial committees to deal with him and I separately. So he had his own judicial committee. I had my own judicial committee. It was that point that I had to tell my parents. And so I told them what happened. My dad asked me just straight out, like, are you gay? And at the time, I honestly didn't think I was. I didn't really know. And so I told him no. And I don't know if I just, I was lying or if I just didn't, you know, I don't even really know what it was. But I told him no, and he was like, okay, that's fine. And to him, that was it. That was all that he needed to hear. You know, my mom, of course, freaked out because, you know, how could you do this to me? And how am I going to look anybody in the eye in the congregation? And, you know, blah, 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 blah. So they came to the judicial committee, which is three elders. They have a chairman and then two other elders. And then during the judicial committee, you're required to basically give a completely detailed account of everything that had happened. Questions like, did you stroke his penis? Did he ejaculate? Did that ejaculate get on you? Did you ever taste his ejaculate? You know, those kind of questions. And it was extremely, like, invasive. And at one point, they kept calling me a fag over and over again. And eventually my dad stepped in and he was like, you know, you guys need to quit with the names and you need to stop doing this. And my mom put her hand on his arm and was like, Larry, you're here out of courtesy. You have no authority here. Please don't speak.
Really?
And he looked at her like, okay. And so then he kind of looked at me and was like, sorry, kid. And he got up and left because he was like, if I don't have any authority here, I'm not going to sit through this. And he got up and left. And so I went through the rest of it with just my mom in the room. And it was decided that there's three different levels of punishment once a judicial committee starts. You are either privately reproved, which means that you lose privileges in the congregation, but there's no announcement made. Nobody is really informed what's going on. It's just you lose some privileges in the congregation and you kind of deal with it with the elders individually. Okay. Then there's public reproof, which means that it's the same thing as private reproof, except that there's an announcement made that you have been publicly reproved. And that's usually done in the instance of both of those will be done if the person is deemed to have been repentant for what they did. If they're truly godly repentant for what they did, then they will be reproved. And it would be made public if people in the congregation were aware of what was happening. And so that's their way of letting the congregation know that it's been dealt with and it's over.
Okay.
And then you can – then the third and most, you know, harsh is that you're disfellowshipped. And that means that you are, you know, put out from the congregation. Nobody in the congregation is allowed to speak to you. Including your family, and so you are completely separated from the congregation 100%.
Yeah.
We were privately reproved, supposedly, which meant there was no announcement made, but two of the elders in my judicial committee went home and told their wives what happened, and so within a week it was throughout the entire congregation. And so everyone knew what had happened between him and I, and it was extremely public, extremely messy, and, you know, it sucked. So okay. His family eventually, I think after a couple of weeks, I think they moved to another hall. I honestly don't really remember what happened to him. I just remember that we never spoke again. And that was always really tough for me because I thought about him pretty much every day for my entire life after that. And
yeah.
There was finally some resolution between him and I later after I left the religion. But, you know, he's still in the organization, and I don't want to really go into that just to maintain his privacy.
Yeah. Okay. So did he finish out high school then in the religion, and you made it through that traumatic thing, and that just sort of must have added to your low self-esteem, but did it at some point start adding against you wanting to participate?
You know, the isolation, I had a really weird ability to compartmentalize a lot of that, and it almost pushed me in deeper because to me the world was a horrible place that was mean and horrible, and it was exactly what you're taught to think it is. You know, I mean, yeah. You're taught to believe that worldly people are all horrible people that are going to take advantage of you and who, you know, would never love you like another Jehovah's Witness would. And so It pushed me probably harder into it, and especially after the situation with the guy in the congregation, it also made me go really, really deep into the closet because I didn't want people to think I was gay. I wanted to live down that reputation. I wanted to eventually have people realize that it was just this passing thing that happened between the two of us, and it really didn't mean anything.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. Music for this podcast was graciously donated by Clayton Pixton. Check him out at claytonpixton.com.
How gentle God's commands, how kind his precepts are. Come cast your burdens on the Lord and trust his constant I'll drop my burden.